You're tuned into the all-new Freedom 106.5
for the Lunchtime Doctor. I would, of course, have the Lunchtime Doctor on the line, Dr. Brittany Dean. Hello, Dr. Dean. How are you?
Good afternoon, please, and good afternoon to all the listeners out there. I hope everybody is having a wonderful and productive day. And, of course, we have another episode that is an interesting topic that many people will experience, and that is bloating. So yesterday we talked a lot about, you know, the need and the importance of just your nutrition, your lifestyle, all of that in your performance on a daily basis. But today I want to discuss one of the symptoms that is very common and something that people do suffer with, including myself, and that is bloating. So today we're going to be focused on bloating, but of course, while we are talking about this specific topic, anybody can feel free to call in or send a WhatsApp on any of their medical topics as well.
Yeah, of course, folks. So make sure to message us about your topics. The WhatsApp numbers will be the same. And of course, you can message our friends at Sky and, of course, Sangeet, and they will let us know in just a short while. So let's get into our topic for today, right? We're talking. Let's start with the basics. What exactly is bloating, and why does the abdomen feel swollen or tight?
So bloating is a sensation of fullness, pressure, or tightness in the abdomen that many people do describe as feeling like their stomach is a bit inflated. Now, when we look at it medically, bloating is something that can occur because of gas being trapped in the abdomen, that gas accumulation. It can be because of digestive disturbances. It can be the food is not moving through your digestive system as it should, so it's altering your gut motility. Or it can also just be that you have increased sensitivity in your gastrointestinal tract. And some people actually do feel bloated without the abdomen actually expanding. But in other cases, we do see that there is visible abdominal distension where the stomach physically enlarges. Now, the digestive tract naturally produces gas during digestion, particularly when bacteria in the large intestine ferment carbohydrates that were not fully digested in the small intestine. However, when we look at bloating, it is not always simply about gas. In many individuals, that issue is going to involve how the gut moves and how sensitive it is to the normal digestive processes that we all go through. And there are certain conditions like slowness in your intestinal movement or poor coordination of your abdominal muscles or even hypersensitivity of the gut nerves that can cause many people to perceive normal amounts of gas that is being produced as uncomfortable or excessive. And that is why two people may eat the same meal and only one of them will experience bloating. So understanding that distinction is what is going to help dispel this myth that we all have that bloating always means that there's too much gas in the stomach.
And how common is bloating, and why do so many people experience it on a regular basis?
Bloating is extremely common, like I mentioned before. In fact, studies actually suggest that 15 to 30% of the general population experiences bloating on a regular basis. And it is definitely one of the most frequent digestive complaints that we do hear in the doctor's office. We do even hear in a hospital setting as well. And of course, when we do look at the genders, women will report bloating more often than men, and that is because of hormonal fluctuations and certain conditions like irritable bowel syndrome. And of course, we have to look at the dietary habits that we have in our modern times as well, because that also contributes significantly, as what we're seeing is many people consuming diets that are high in the refined carbohydrates and the artificial sweeteners and the processed foods that can disrupt normal digestion. Now, another major factor, I would say, is lifestyle. So eating very quickly, experiencing chronic stress, sitting for prolonged periods of time, consuming a lot of carbonated beverages, all of that can contribute to the accumulation of gas or impaired digestive functioning. And in addition to that, many individuals will now consume large quantities of foods that are healthy in moderation. So the legumes, the high fiber vegetables, the certain greens, but in excess, those can actually ferment in the gut and produce gas. So bloating is a reflection of a combination of your dietary habits, your gut bacteria, your digestion, and of course, lifestyle factors, rather than just pointing to one single cause.
Once again, folks, of course, feel free to send us your messages at 306-1065. You can also message our friends at Sangeet and Sky, and they will send any of your medical questions to us here in studio as we continue to talk about bloating. What are some of the most common everyday causes of bloating?
So one of the most frequent causes of bloating is gas that is produced during digestion, particularly when carbohydrates are fermented by bacteria in the colon. So foods such as the beans and the lentils and onions and cabbage and broccoli and even whole grains will contain compounds that can produce gas during that breakdown. Even the carbonated beverages will also introduce air directly into the digestive system, and that can contribute to the sensation of fullness or pressure. Eating too quickly as well can cause individuals to swallow air, and that is actually a process that has its own name. We call that aerophagia, and that can worsen bloating. And another everyday contributor is actually constipation, because that slows the movement of food and gas through the digestive tract. Now, when stool accumulates in the colon, it does create some pressure and promotes the gas buildup. Additionally, things like stress and anxiety will affect your nervous system, and that is what regulates digestion as well. The gut and the brain communicate very closely through that gut-brain axis, and stress can slow down digestion or alter a person's gut sensitivity. That's why many people will notice bloating during periods of emotional stress or after irregular eating patterns.
All right, we have another question. Is bloating usually related to something we eat, or can it also be caused by underlying medical conditions?
So while diet does play a significant role in bloating, it is very important for us to also recognize that bloating can also be associated with other underlying medical conditions. So the common gastrointestinal disorders that we do see that leads to chronic bloating would be something like irritable bowel syndrome, lactose intolerance, and even celiac disease. Those conditions in particular will interfere with normal digestion or the absorption of nutrients from foods, and that causes food to ferment in the intestines and produce gas. And in those cases, bloating tends to occur repeatedly, and it will also be accompanied by other symptoms like abdominal pain or diarrhea or constipation. Now, in the less common cases, bloating can actually signal more serious health issues. So conditions like ovarian cancer or intestinal obstruction, inflammatory bowel disease, liver disease, all of those things can also cause abdominal swelling. But those situations are typically associated with additional symptoms like the persistent abdominal pain, unexplained weight loss, vomiting, changes in bowel habits. So the key thing to understand is that occasional bloating after meals is definitely common, but persistent or worsening bloating is definitely something that needs to be evaluated by your medical doctor.
And many people notice bloating after certain foods. Which foods are most common triggers?
So this is definitely something many people will want to know about. And there are certain foods that are known to produce gas during digestion because they contain what we call fermentable carbohydrates. And those carbohydrates are sometimes referred to as FODMAPs, or FODMAPs, which stands for fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. Now, foods that are high in these compounds would be like the onion and the garlic and the wheat and the beans and the lentils, even apples and certain dairy products in lactose intolerant individuals, and even artificial sweeteners like the sorbitol. When those substances reach the large intestine, the gut bacteria tends to ferment them and produces gas as a natural byproduct. But it is definitely important to essentially debunk this myth that these foods are bad for you, because that process can happen. Many of them are still highly nutritious because they provide fiber and vitamins and beneficial plant compounds. So the issue is not necessarily the food itself, but how an individual's digestive system is going to handle that food. Some people just have the reduced ability to digest certain carbohydrates, or may have gut bacteria that produce more gas during fermentation. So it is important for us to be able to identify personal triggers through processes like mindful eating, or even elimination diets in some people can help to manage their symptoms without unnecessarily avoiding the healthy foods.
Once again, folks, we will be taking some of your calls and some of your questions in just a short while, as we do our lunchtime doctor, of course, Mondays to Wednesdays, right here on Freedom 106.5 FM, Sankit 106.1, and Sky 99.5. And is there a difference between feeling bloated and actually having abdominal swelling or distension?
So, yes, there is a significant difference between bloating and abdominal distension, although sometimes we do see those terms being used interchangeably. Bloating is going to refer to the subjective sensation of fullness or pressure in the abdomen. So a person may feel extremely bloated even if their abdomen appears normal in size. That sensation will often occur because of heightened sensitivity of the nerves in the gastrointestinal tract, which is common in conditions like we mentioned before, like irritable bowel syndrome. Now, when we look at abdominal distension, it is the objective enlargement of the abdomen, meaning the stomach itself visibly expands. And this may occur when there's an accumulation of gas or fluid or even stool in the digestive tract. Distension is something that can also occur because of the impaired coordination of the abdominal muscles and the diaphragm during the digestive process itself. So it is important for us to understand that distinction, because it will help your own doctor determine whether the issues related to just gas accumulation, muscle coordination, or even just heightened sensitivity of the gut.
All right, so let's get some questions in here right now from some of our listeners. Right, 3061065, message Sangeet, and of course Sky. Could coughing send up blood pressure?
So when we look at coughing by itself, in a person that already has been diagnosed with high blood pressure, it can temporarily raise your blood pressure for a few seconds, but it is not a factor or risk factor that contributes to chronic high blood pressure. When you cough, there are several things that will occur in the body. It is going to activate your fight or flight system, and that is your stress-related system, and it's going to release adrenaline in the body, and that is just going to send up your blood pressure for a very short space of time, but it is going to normalize after that. It is not a contributor to chronic high blood pressure.
Good day, doctor. How can you tell the difference between a lump under your arm or a bump under your arm?
So, I mean, when we're looking at lump or bumps, the thing about it is there are going to be several differential diagnoses. So a diagnosis cannot be a lump or a diagnosis cannot be a bump. So let's start there. Your diagnosis is going to be based on the size, the shape, the fluctuance, if it moves, the mobility of it, the borders that are surrounding it as well. And when we look at the difference between the bump is more small, a raised area of the skin. It tends to be very superficial. It's more of the outer layers. The lump is deeper. It's more of a swelling or mass under the skin within the bodily tissues as itself. The important thing to note here is that we can't just say lump or bump. There are differential diagnoses for either one, and it is going to be dependent on other symptoms that you may be experiencing in addition to just seeing that lump or bump.
Mm-hmm. Good day, doctor. Recently I tested my blood sugar. It was 140 over 97, which suggests I am type 2 hypertensive 2. What can I do to lower my blood pressure, and is this very serious?
So, yes, that means that your blood pressure is within a certain range and you now have been diagnosed with high blood pressure. In order to bring that blood pressure reading down, the first thing that we have to do is look at your lifestyle. What are the foods that you are eating? Is it highly refined, salty foods, fatty foods? Those things need to be reduced immediately. In addition to that, are you getting any sort of movement or exercise in on a daily basis? If you have high blood pressure, we have to definitely look at 150 minutes of moderate intensity activity per week. That could be brisk walking, cycling, swimming, whatever it is, to make sure that you get that aerobic intensity into your daily life. The reason for that is because exercise has been proven to lower your blood pressure, and it also helps to calm your nervous system. So for a lot of people, that blood pressure may be heightened because of stress, and whether that is stress physically or stress from emotional, mental conditions, or even work stress, your body is going to perceive all stress the same exact way. And therefore, that anything that will lower that stress level for you is going to contribute to lowering your blood pressure. Those are two of the main things that I will definitely start with, but at least getting a 10 to 20 minute walk in a day will be beneficial.
Person also says here that they do tend to walk a lot, get some exercise. They don't feel any pain or anything with their heart or anything, and they're very surprised how their blood pressure is up that high. Maybe could it do anything with your diet and salt?
Yeah, definitely. So, but I mean, in a lot of people who do not feel anything, remember, we call hypertension the silent killer, because nobody experiences symptoms until the complications start to occur from high blood pressure. But in this day and age, a lot of people are being diagnosed with hypertension just because of the fact that they are stressed out on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. All right, Doc. So, Doc, what you could do right now, you could join back the Zoom, so we could join our friends out there at Dalton Brown.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so you could join back our friends out there on Zoom. Mm-hmm. You're locked on to Freedom 106.5 FM, Sangit 106.1, Sky 99.5, the lunchtime. Dr. Bass is in. I know I said I would have been out for a little 2 weeks, but I'll explain that after the show. So we're getting ready to talk to our friends at Dalton Brong Optometrist. The doctor will be logging back in. And of course, remember the lunchtime doctor right here on Freedom 106.5 FM, Sangit 106.1, and Sky 99.5. We have just about 2 more minutes for our friends at Dalton Brong to get back on to us. Let's see if we did have any more questions there. Right, Dr. Brittany Dean is in. Right, so let's see, Dr. Dean, where's your social line? All right, so hello, Doc, you there?
Yes.
All right, nice, beautiful. All right, so let's just wrap up our topic on the bloating before we get back to our friends at Dalton Brong Optometrist. I guess I'll ask you the final question. For someone who experiences frequent bloating, when should they seek medical advice or further testing?
So when we look at people who are complaining of bloating, we definitely suggest that you seek medical advice or you go to your doctor when you start to experience persistent bloating that becomes worse if that bloating is accompanied by other symptoms. For example, high fever, if you're getting persistent abdominal pain, if you are noticing that your skin is turning yellow, your eyes are turning yellow, this can be suggestive of some sort of liver pathology. If you're noticing changes in your stool, as well as the frequency of when you use the toilet, so if that is diarrhea or constipation for you, those are things that signal to me that there's something underlying, as opposed to the bloating just being because you ate a specific food and it has resolved one time. So it is definitely imperative to understand that many people will experience bloating on a daily basis, but it is also important for people to know that there are other conditions that can be associated with that bloating. And your doctor may recommend certain blood tests, stool tests, even breath tests for certain lactose intolerance or bacterial overgrowth, or even imaging studies to determine the cause of those symptoms. The goal is really to identify whether bloating is due to your diet, your digestive function, or a medical condition. And early evaluation will help to ensure that the appropriate treatment is given to you and prevent further complications.
All right, Doc, so this is where I'll let you lead the way with our friends at Dalton Brong Optometrist and see what's up in store today. We say hi to our friends out there, Dalton Brong. Hello.
Hi, good day.
Good day. So today we're going to be talking about how our eyes change as we age. Is that correct?
Yes, we are.
Okay, so let's get into the first question. So why is it particularly important to monitor your eye health more frequently as you age?
So as time goes on, the systems in our body sometimes just doesn't work as well as they would have used to, you know, when you were a baby or a teenager or even a young adult. So this in turn can reflect in your eye health. So this is why sometimes we may notice changes in our vision. In some instances, these problems may have an easy fix with corrective lenses or maybe some lubricating eye drops. But other times, it can be something systemic that causes these changes to come about in our vision. In that case, it's very rare that the issue is resolved with glasses alone. According to WHO, 1 in 5 people aged 65 and older has a vision impairment that cannot be corrected with glasses or contact lenses. So as we age, the risk of eye disease increases, yet many older adults neglect to keep up with their routine eye exams, which usually helps us to prevent or detect and manage early signs of vision impairment and therefore improve their visual prognosis.
Thank you. And what are some of the common conditions that people will usually develop as they age?
So one of the most common age-related conditions would be something called presbyopia, which makes it difficult for persons to perform near tasks So presbyopia is not something dangerous and it's typically corrected with glasses or contact lenses. Some other age-related changes would include cataract, diabetic retinopathy, and age-related macular degeneration. However, so these actually result in vision loss, but these things cannot be resolved with just glasses or contact lenses.
And in addition to that, can you give us a bit of insight into what a person might experience with each condition?
Sure, so I'll just go through them one by one. In terms of presbyopia, it occurs as the internal lens becomes less flexible and stiffer, making it difficult to shift focus from distance to near objects. So what usually happens, and one of the most common complaints that we get, is that persons, they have to start pushing their phone further away to see things better, or they can't really make out the fine print on the medicine bottles or when they're reading their religious books. This usually happens around 40. Now, some people experience it a little bit earlier. Some people experience it a little bit later. And that is easily corrected with glasses. In terms of cataract, it's the crystalline lens of the eyes becoming cloudy over time. So people with cataract usually describe it as looking through a fog or dirty window. When they are out and about in the hot sun, they tend to feel as though the glare can be very overwhelming for them. And they usually do have a lot of problem with nighttime driving. So overall, their vision is cloudy, even if they do have their corrective lenses on. In terms of diabetic retinopathy, it's a serious sight-threatening complication of diabetes that damages the blood vessels in the retina behind the eyes. It's caused by high blood sugar levels, and it can progress from mild, symptomless, non-proliferative stages to severe vision-stealing stages. Early on, someone with diabetic retinopathy may not notice anything is wrong, which is why we sound like a broken record when telling persons with diabetes that they need to check their eyes every year. Patients usually notice these symptoms much later on when the damages have already occurred, and those can include dark spots in their vision. Things may look wavy. Recognizing facial features becomes challenging. So sometimes you might notice sudden changes in your vision, as well if there's also bleeding behind the eyes. And the last one I'll just touch on would be age-related macular degeneration, which affects your central vision. So you might notice that seeing fine details or recognizing facial features becomes a bit challenging. So typically you'll notice distortion when reading, looking at straight lines, or you can also perceive a dark spot in the middle of your vision. So with this, your peripheral or your side vision is usually okay, but the central vision, you may have issues. Age-related macular degeneration month was actually attributed to February, so we actually wanted to touch a little more on that today as well.
That's very interesting. Maybe you'd like to give us a little more information on that age-related macular degeneration, since there's an entire month dedicated to raising awareness of that condition.
Yes. So age-related macular degeneration, also known as macular degeneration, is an acquired degeneration of the retina. It's a significant central visual impairment. So your peripheral or side vision will still be normal. Just for an example, imagine looking at a clock with hands. With age-related macular degeneration, you might see the clock's numbers, but not the hands. So it's actually quite common, and it's the leading cause of vision loss in people 50 years or older. So there's actually two types of it. There is dry age-related macular degeneration, which is the most common form. In this form, it's basically when parts of the macula gets thinner with age and tiny clumps of protein called drusen grows. So people with dry age-related macular degeneration have an area of cell loss in the retina, which is how you slowly lose your central vision. The other type is wet age-related macular degeneration. This is actually a little more rare and more serious. Just to touch back on the dry AMD, it actually worsens over a period of time. So it usually slowly progresses over years. You'll notice the vision starts to deteriorate. As opposed to wet AMD, it worsens quickly, so sometimes in days or weeks. And what happens here, it's when new abnormal blood vessels grow under the retina, and these vessels may leak blood or fluid, causing scarring of the macula. So you tend to lose vision a bit faster with this form. Now, many people don't realize that they have AMD until their vision is very blurry. So that's why it's very important to have regular visits to your optometrist or ophthalmologist so that, you know, we can look for the early signs before you have any severe vision problems.
And what are some of the risk factors for age-related macular degeneration?
So some risk factors would include a diet high in saturated fats, so like meat, butter, and cheese, persons who are overweight, persons who smoke cigarettes. So if you smoke, your risk for AMD could be up to 4 times as much as someone who's never smoked. So this is probably because the smoking usually reduces the amount of oxygen that goes to different parts of your body, including the eyes. Another risk factor would be 50 years and older. So the normal aging processes can lead to structural and blood flow changes that can predispose patients to AMD. Hypertension is another risk factor, and then family history of it as well.
And do eye vitamins or supplements actually help with conditions like age-related macular degeneration?
So that's a question we actually get asked quite a lot, and the short answer is yes. So for patients, for certain patients, they absolutely can help. Large clinical studies show that specific formulations of antioxidants and minerals such as lutein can slow the progression of moderate to advanced dry AMD. So it's important to note that the supplements do not cure it and they do not prevent it entirely, but in the right stage of the condition or at the right time, it can definitely reduce the risk of it progressing to a more severe form. So the key here to really understand is that it is patient dependent, and that's why we have the responsibility of assessing each patient carefully so that we can tailor their care accordingly. For instance, at our office, we have 2 supplements that we usually recommend to patients showing signs of, or we know that are at risk of AMD. They are Occuvisi and Vitalux eye supplements. So why we use them is because they are formulated based on the research and design to support macular health. So in essence, it is not about just taking like random supplements off the shelf, but it's more about targeted supplementation for the person at the right time.
And in addition to that, just stepping away a little bit from age-related macular degeneration, particularly when we're looking at our female listeners, how does menopause actually play a role when it comes to dry eyes?
That's a great question, because many women don't understand how their eyes change during menopause. They just kind of know that it does change. In a nutshell, what happens is that during or after menopause, hormone levels like estrogen and androgens, they tend to fluctuate and decrease. And those hormones play a role in maintaining a healthy and stable tear film. So they support the glands that produce the tears, which will be the meibomian glands. Now, with the fluctuation of one's hormones, some of those glands tend to stop functioning completely, which means that the tear production reduces, the tears evaporate faster, and then this results in the dry eyes, right? So women going through this might feel like their eyes are burning, they might feel like if it's gritty or they have gravel in the eyes. They might also get some glare issues, so when they're outside in the hot sun, they might feel really uncomfortable, or they might feel like if they can't keep their eyes open for long periods of time. Now, as I said, this is a really common occurrence, but it often goes undiagnosed because patients kind of just write it off as too much screen time or not drinking enough water, etc., right? Now, those things do have a role to play, yes, but when it comes to hormonal changes, just a little bit more intense. Now, luckily at our office, we have equipment to do a dry eye assessment, which allows us to see whether it's that the tear glands are not functioning or if the quality of the tears is not sufficient, etc. So that way we could treat your dry eyes a little bit better and faster.
And can you tell us how of these age-related conditions are diagnosed?
So the good news there is that most of the conditions can be detected during a comprehensive eye exam, often before the patient notices anything themselves. So we use a combination of vision testing, which would be seeing how well you see with and without glasses or contacts. Then we would examine both the front and the back of the eyes. So we're looking for things like cataracts or abnormalities with blood vessels to the back of the eye. And for things like ARMD or diabetic retinopathy, we would use digital imaging on our OCT machine, which allows us to analyze very detailed cross-sectional images of the back of the eye, the blood vessels, the optic nerve, and the macula, which is the most sensitive part of the eye. So that's why, as Andrea said, the routine eye exams are so important for us to be able to help you by doing all of these specific tests.
And how can we prevent age-related eye conditions?
So we can't completely prevent them, but we could absolutely reduce the risk and slow the progression in many cases. So lifestyle changes make a huge difference, whether it be ceasing smoking, managing your blood pressure, as you were talking about in the session before, managing your sugar and or your cholesterol levels, wearing proper UV protection. So this might be via polarized sunglasses. You could use broad-rimmed hats. You could use umbrellas. Making sure you exercise regularly as best as possible, eating a very balanced diet, which would include, for sure, leafy greens and omega-3s. Now, for certain patients, as we discussed, supplements might help maintain eye health or at least slow the progression of conditions like the moderate ARMD. So essentially, it's not about total prevention, but we could reduce the risk, we could prolong the onset of certain conditions, and we could certainly slow the progression where possible.
And do you think that people coming too late to have their eyes tested after experiencing symptoms of some of those conditions you mentioned earlier?
Unfortunately, yes. More often than not, we see patients whose conditions have already significantly impacted their eyes. And we find that is usually because either the conditions are developing gradually, painlessly, and without any symptoms whatsoever. So the patient doesn't notice anything. Or if they do notice changes, they kind of just palm it off on getting older. And this is why we encourage routine eye exams. As Andrea said, we sound like a broken record at this point, because even though your vision seems fine, you know, you never know what's going on behind the eyes or in front of the eyes, you know? So too many people think visiting the optometrist is just about getting glasses, but it's not. That might be part of it, yeah, but sometimes when you come in for your annual eye exams, sometimes the optometrist knows that your glasses probably wouldn't need to change, but it's just that we told you to come back in a year because you're worried that the health of your eyes would change. And it's always easier to help you when we pick up on those things earlier rather than later, right? Now, it's a lot harder to help patients when things have progressed and sometimes requires more tedious treatment. And it may even get to the point where we have to refer you to an ophthalmologist because they have to help you as well, you know? And one of the hardest things that we have to do almost daily is explain to someone that their conditions have gotten significantly worse just because they waited too long to be seen by an eye care professional, whether it be the optometrist or the ophthalmologist. Now, not only is it the person's responsibility to have their eyes tested regularly, but it's also our responsibility to make eye care more accessible to the general public. So some of our listeners might notice, if you keep an eye out, you might notice that an optical is doing a vision screening in your area. Sometimes they do it in the libraries, they do it in the health centers, they do it in like the community center sometimes if they have a health fair. And these screenings are free. They don't replace a full eye exam though. but it gives us a better chance at letting you know if you need to urgently have your eyes checked. Because a lot of times in these screenings, we at least check your vision, or we do a quick health, a quick check of the health of the eyes as well, so we're able to give you enough information to know that you really need to go and have the eyes sorted out, right? So whenever you see or hear that these screenings are happening, you should try your best to go to them and just have a conversation with the optometrist as well. If you don't want to go through the test, that's fine. But just ask a question, let them know when last you tested the eyes, explain, you know, different things that you're concerned about, be it with your eyes or if you're here, you know, your neighbor had something wrong with their eyes and you want to know if it could happen to you too. All of those things we could use to encourage you to get a full test done just to see how your eyes are going. And over the years, we've done vision screenings and we noticed that it gives the persons the extra push that they need to book that eye appointment that they've been putting off for months or even years. So y'all could look out for those types of things. And even if not, it's always a good idea to just book the appointment just to be safe.
But how often should adults be getting their eyes tested?
For most adults under 60 years of age, every 2 years is generally appropriate once they don't have any other risk factors. So when they get their test, the optometrist would usually advise them, okay, it might be better if you test a little bit more frequently because of X, Y, or Z. Persons 60 and over, we usually suggest the annual eye exams. Another thing is that persons that have things like diabetes, high blood pressure, or maybe people in their family have macular degeneration or glaucoma, they may need to be seen more regularly as well, just so that we could monitor them closely with the OCT scan that I mentioned earlier, which is the cross-sectional images of the back of the eye. They should also do visual field tests, which maps out how far you could see peripherally. So this is particularly if you're getting older and you're driving, this would be a good test for you to do off and on, just to make sure that you're seeing enough on the sides. And another good test that they should do is the dry eye assessments to monitor the health of the glands where the tears are produced and the quality of the tears as well, because all of those things tend to change as you age. But all of these things, depending on your age, the different conditions that you have, your family history, when you have the eyes tested, initially the optometrist would advise you on what the plan should be moving forward, whether they'll want to see every year, every 2 years, or maybe every 6 months, depending.
And any closing thoughts at the end of our listeners?
Yeah, so as we age, the changes in our vision are common, but they shouldn't be ignored though. So conditions like presbyopia, cataracts, macular degeneration, and the diabetic eye disease, they all affect different parts of the eye, and it affects each person differently as well. So the encouraging thing is that many of these conditions can be detected early, often before the patient notices any symptoms, through a comprehensive eye examination. And in many cases, we can slow the progression, manage those symptoms, and offer very effective treatment options. Simple lifestyle choices also make a real difference, as I mentioned just now. Not smoking, protecting your eyes from UV exposure, managing your blood pressure, sugar, cholesterol, maintaining a healthy diet, and including some exercise there as well. And we tend to tell patients what's good for your heart and your brain is often really good for your eyes as well. So on that note, the same way how you'd have your regular GP checkups, make eye exams a part of your routine checks every year as well, you know? So ultimately, those regular eye exams aren't just about updating your glasses or your contact lenses alone. It's an important part of protecting your long-term vision and your overall health.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today and enlightening us about all of these age-related changes that occur within our eyes, and of course, encouraging us to make sure that we get our eyes tested when necessary. But of course, stay on the line, because I'm sure that there may be some persons who will have some questions about their eyes as well.
Yes, for sure.
All right, so any folks out there with any questions, feel free to give us a message there at 306-1065. Let me just put back up the WhatsApp here. All right, let's see if you had any questions coming in. All right, good afternoon. Can a question here about a detached retina. Can a detached retina be reconnected? Any hope, any procedure? I only just joined the discussion.
Okay, so that is another condition that is assessed on a case-by-case basis. Unfortunately, optometrists can't treat detached retina. That's solely up to the ophthalmologist, but it is very urgent. So I'm not sure if you had an eye test done and the optometrist had picked up that you had the detached retina, they would have most likely given you a letter to go to an ophthalmologist as soon as possible, like immediately. And the ophthalmologist would have to assess how, like, the location, how severe it is and different things, and they would be able to tell you if, one, if it can be reattached given the overall health of the eyes, and two, if the reattachment will restore any of your vision. So that's a conversation you need to have with the ophthalmologist.
All right. Is a muscular hole same as muscular degeneration?
Okay, so we're going to assume that that person meant macular hole and macular degeneration.
Yes, macular. Yes, macular. I'm saying muscular. Macular.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, no, it's not the same thing. The macular hole can sometimes come about as a result of the fluid in the eyes pulling at that part. So the macula is within the retina, and there's a bit of fluid in front of the retina that can sometimes pull at it, and it would literally hold to form at that part of the eye, right? Now, it does cause issues with your central vision. So when we were talking about the macular degeneration, we mentioned that it does cause your central vision to deteriorate. But the hole is slightly different. You tend to see things a lot more wavy, or some patients tend to say they can't, if they're looking at someone, they can't recognize their face, but they know, like, they could recognize the rest of their features, so like their arms, their legs, and whatever. But it's the way that it's formed is a bit different, and the what the patient experiences visually is a bit different, and they're also treated much, much differently as well. The macular hole, it requires most times it requires some sort of surgery to just hold the layers of the retina in place so that the hole doesn't get larger, whereas with the macular degeneration, especially with the dry form, usually it's just monitoring and the supplements and stuff. With the wet form, they might need different injections and stuff like that, but the likelihood of needing surgery for the macular degeneration is much lower than with the macular hole. Again, this is something that the ophthalmologist would discuss with you when they're talking about treatment and whatnot.
All right, what could be causing a sudden itching of the eye?
So itching can come about due to many issues. It could be an eye infection. It could be allergies, because there is a lot of Sahara dust in the air right now. So the only way we'll be able to tell or to help treat that would be if you come in for us to have an eye exam so we can assess the front of the eyes to see what's going on pertaining to that. If it's an infection, we may need to refer. And if it is just itching due to the allergies, then we're able to prescribe certain drops to help you with that.
All right, and as you mentioned, eye drops, they're speaking of eye drops. How are these over-the-counter eye drops safe to use?
Well, if you're referring to the one that we would have given for the itching, yes, it is. As optometrists, we're only allowed to recommend over-the-counter eye drops. So those would be like the allergy eye drops for itching. And then the lubricating eye drops. Anything else that requires a prescription, you will need to see the ophthalmologist for.
Somebody says, yeah, you said it thinks you should test your eyes every 2 years. Is it that your prescription may change? But what if your prescription does not change? Do you think the optometrist will be honest enough to tell you that you don't need to change, or is it that it will always need to change?
So that's a great question. Usually here, I could only speak for here, adults and wrong optometrists, while yes, we do recommend to test every year or every 2 years, depending on the patient's situation, we will always tell them if the prescription would have remained the same or not, because ideally the purpose of testing every year or every 2 years is not only to assess the prescription, but it's also to assess the health of the eyes. So let's say a patient came in today and I would have seen them in 2025, so today would have been a year and the prescription remained the same, I would simply give the patient the option, you know, it's optional. Do you want to update your glasses? Or if not, you don't have to. We can wait another year because the prescription would have remained the same.
Can you buy your frames elsewhere and just come in and get the prescribed lenses that you need?
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely an option because we understand that people have different tastes and they might want a specific style and whatnot. So yeah, that's totally fine. When you come in, you just bring your frame with you, you try it on, and then our optician will do the measurements and whatnot and explain everything to you from there.
They will also advise, though, if the frame is suitable in terms of size, because those patients who are 40 and over, they would either need like the bifocals or the progressive lenses. So while, yes, they can, they will also still get advice from the optician to make sure it's a suitable frame to use.
All right, ladies, we just have about a minute and a half. Once again, can you give them all the information they need to call in? Another question came in here. Sorry, I missed your program. I have glaucoma, and sometimes I see little flickers of light, but not often. Would my ophthalmologist pick up anything if it was serious?
Yeah, for sure. So even as, especially if you mentioned that to them, they would have done a specific test just to make sure that they rule out whatever is causing those flickers of light. So it would be worth your while to mention it to them next time if you haven't already. But if you're just asking because you're wondering if they should have picked it up last time, yes, they would have, and they would have advised you accordingly.
Nice. So I invite you right now to give out all the information as possible so that people could get in contact with you guys at Dalton Brown Optometrist.
Sure. So for those of you that want to come in and have your eyes tested and whatnot, we are located on the corner of Queen and Susanna Street in Arima. And to book your appointments, you can call 667-3115, and you could also call or WhatsApp 299-3115. So we're looking forward to see some of you coming in to have your eyes checked.
Beautiful. All right, friends. Well, thank you there very much.
Thank you.
All right, and of course, Dr. Dean, we'll catch you tomorrow.
You're tuned into the all-new Freedom 106.5.